Welcome to This Is Money. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And today, it's Simon and Lee's favourite subject. We're talking all about loyalty and loyalty schemes. The original Tesco is back in the game, while Nationwide is out. Are they worth it to us and to businesses, though? Also, two for the price of one, how buying a home instead of renting could leave you over 350 grand richer over 30 years. Plus, should you back shares where bosses have skin in the game? And we take a look at Britain's best workhorse cars. And don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, we've heard a lot of talk about loyalty recently, haven't we? Particularly in regards to utility companies ripping off customers who stick with them rather than switching about. And us wise sages, of course, have been saying loyalty doesn't pay when it comes to business for years. Or does it? Now, Tesco were the original loyalty scheme pioneers. Then everybody jumped on the bandwagon, and then everyone seemed to sort of jump off again, including Tesco. But lo, the supermarket giant is back in the game with a relaunched Club Card Plus. Now, I know how much of a fan you guys are of loyalty cards, particularly. They're not at all. I have many. But before we get carried away, this week, Nationwide, and it's not exactly a loyalty card, but it's loyalty nonetheless, loyalty in name, shall we say, announced it was scrapping its hugely popular loyalty savings account. Now, apparently they're revamping the range. Right. Okay. First and foremost, I'm not libelling you or anything here, Lee. You are not a fan of loyalty schemes generally?
Generally, it's a trade-off, isn't it, between giving away your personal data for what can be minuscule amount of discounts off your shopping, for example. So it all depends on what you're trading off and what you're going to get in return. But that's not to say that there aren't some good loyalty schemes out there.
And so coffee stamps, you're right, because you don't have to sign up to anything.
Exactly, and I can still pay by cash, and it's all good, George, isn't it? You know, they've got no details. I'm not having to, like, you know, it's just a bit of paper. I like that, and it's just stamped on a piece of paper. That's fine. But the thing is with that, though, still, it might influence your habits, because you might go, oh, I might still just keep going back to that coffee shop rather than going elsewhere. And that's what sometimes, again, I'm not too keen on loyalty cards. All of these supermarkets mainly have one, but the irony is most people have all of them. You know what I mean? So it's not like, you know, you get a Tesco Club card and you keep going to Tesco every week. And people just aren't really, on the whole, I would argue, that loyal to something like a supermarket. They'd rather now these days shop around a little bit. And, you know, it's all about what you're doing to build it into your day. So, for example, if you do your shop at the weekend and you're going to visit, you know, your in-laws or whatever, you might go to a different supermarket to build it into your day. That's what I don't really get with these loyalty schemes. I don't know how many people verbatimly go in, week out, and stick to somewhere like Sainsbury's with a Nectar card and just keep getting the points. I have a Nectar card. Yeah. I do collect points when I go into Sainsbury's, but I don't purposefully go into Sainsbury's every week to do my shop because I've got an extra card.
The word loyalty, then. If we're not loyal to companies, and we know companies aren't loyal to us, because I'll talk about Nationwide in a minute, can we just scrap the word altogether?
I don't think so, because on occasions, very few occasions, loyalty can pay. Right, but it doesn't happen that often. There has been a bit more of a veer towards companies trying to, you know, reward those loyal customers, but even then it still doesn't feel like it's enough. And actually, you touched on earlier, Georgie, about we're told all the time, for example, to switch our energy bills. Now, you know, only this week we've seen another energy company go bust, and that kind of makes people go, well, why will I switch away? You know, what's the point when at the end of the day another company might go bust? We've had latest current account switching figures out for the last 5 years. I think 6 million people have switched current account, which on the face of it sounds quite impressive, but I don't know if it does.
When you think some of them are offering like 100 quid or something.
Yeah, and they're massive bribes to switch away from what is your main current account to another provider. And people are getting used to this kind of, well, let's move around. You know, what loyalty doesn't pay. What's the point of me sticking somewhere if I'm not being rewarded? Now, Nationwide has done something.
Yeah, explain what they've been doing.
In recent years, it's had this loyalty saver, and last year it launched its loyalty ISA. So depending on how long you've been with Britain's biggest building society, meant you got a higher rate, which actually, I think in theory, sounds quite good. So if you've been with it for more than 15 years, you got the top rate. If you were with it between 10 and 15 years, you got a slightly reduced rate. 5 to 10 years, slightly reduced rate, and 0 to 5 years, slightly reduced rate. So the fear, the idea of that is that you'll stick with Nationwide over the years because you go, well, you know, I'm going to now be with them for 10 years, so I'm going to get slightly more interest. And we're talking here a top-tier interest of 1.1%, so it's not something that's going to set the world alight. However, it was popular, Georgie. More than 1.5 million.
Slim pickings at the moment.
Slim pickings. And Simon and I were having this conversation in the office this week about savings. And the fact is, a lot of people like to have their main current account and they like to have their savings pot in the same place so they can see it. It's easy. You don't have to remember another login. And that trade-off is you might end up with a little bit less interest. Now, for some people, that's what they want to do for the sake of ease instead of earning just a tiny bit of interest elsewhere. For others, they will switch around all of the time. You know, Nationwide is so popular at the moment, Georgie. We looked at, as I mentioned, those current account switching figures earlier. It's had 500,000 people switch to it. You know, net inflows of people, more people have switched to it than switched away from it to another bank. So it's doing something right. It's attracting customers. It's still got a you know, pretty decent high street presence, and people are going with it. But something like this, I think, is you're going to annoy a slap of those 1.5 million customers, aren't you, Georgie, that have kind of got used to the idea of, oh, wow, look, Nationwide's doing something different. It's rewarding me for my loyalty. It's revamping the range, which is a classic, you know, spin of it's probably going to be worse.
Yes, exactly.
So they've launched a member-only bond. So instead of loyalty, it's just a member-only bond. So it's the same rate for no matter how long you've been with Nationwide. One and a half percent over 18 months. It can be beaten in our Best Buy tables. It's not going to set the world alight, but at least there's something there. Now, what I think is happening, and still, and this has been going on for a long time, Georgie, it's just such a hot mortgage war. I mean, mortgage rates continue. We keep saying how much longer can these rates remain this low? But we are talking mortgage rates at a absolutely minuscule level historically. You know, it's incredible. And these margins are, you know, getting more and more squeezed for someone like Nationwide, and they're having to look where they can trim some interest back and to pay out some interest to savers. And this is exactly what's happening. I think it's a bit sad, Georgie, to be honest with you. And actually, when you look at the comments, people seem to have quite got onto this concept, and it's almost like, well, why are you now knocking it down?
You
know, they only launched this loyalty ISA last year, which offered, you know, better rates of interest, again depending on how long you've been with Nationwide, and then they just pulled it.
So this is the problem, though, isn't it? And this is why I don't like using the word loyalty, because there's sort of a, it's quite emotive. Do we really have loyalty as we understand, as I understand loyalty, when it comes to things like businesses? Look, if I've got my money in account and a hot young thing comes along offering me a better rate, I'm not going to be loyal to that. Do you know what I mean? It's just a word.
I think there's a
Get rid of it.
People might confuse loyalty to inertia. So, you know,
exactly.
For example, you know, we've had this conversation a couple of times, Georgie, about British Gas. It's a classic example. People go, "Oh, it's British Gas. It's, you know, I've been with them for decades and I've never had a problem." And but they, you know, might be charging you far more than you could get, you know, from another energy supplier. So people confuse that to loyalty. Well, I've been with them so long, you know, they must be treating me right. And it just does not work like that. And I think that's where people get a little bit confused. And you're talking now about a hot young thing.
But that's not loyalty. That's basically, it's either inertia or it's basically saying...
But it is loyalty in a way, isn't it? Because you've been with them
for decades.
Yeah, but
you're saying, well, because they've been good. They've been fine. I don't know I'll get anything better. That's not really loyalty. It's like a business transaction. They've done well for you. You've done well out of it. Boom.
You've been loyal, haven't you? You've been with them for a long time. But no, I'm agreeing with you. It's just inertia. People just don't want to switch. They don't want to rock the boat. They don't want to, you know, the fear of their energy, you know, being cut off, or, you know, going to another firm and that firm going bust, or, you know, some billing issues or something that's going to go wrong. And I could totally understand that, but I wouldn't confuse that with loyalty. That is just inertia. And, you know, if you're not getting rewarded for something, what's the point of staying loyal? You know, that's what I think. You said there about moving to a hot young thing, you know, if you see a rate. But, you know, people are increasingly doing that. But one of the big reasons that they're doing that is that they're very, that these app-based banks, for example, they're very, you know, easy to use. If you are someone that carries a smartphone around all the time, which, let's face it, a large majority of Britons are now, you know, I like that style of banking now. They get instant alerts of when they spent something. They can, you know, see how it's broken down into different spending habits. All that type of thing has meant people are more and more willing to give them a go. And that is a fear of the banks at the moment. They are, I think, running quite scared. Think it's good for customers because someone like NatWest and RBS are offering £175 to switch current account to it. £175 of cold cash.
Simon, what's your views? Come on, you sat there quietly.
Well, I suppose, yes, you can confuse inertia for loyalty, but I think I'll draw on two personal examples, okay? And I'll tell you which one I think is just inertia and possibly stupidity upon my part, and which one is loyalty. I have been a customer of two companies for the same, roughly the same amount of time. Virgin Media, but no. Which was actually previously, maybe it was Telewest or NTL, can't remember. It was one of them. That was what morphed into Virgin Media. And Nationwide. Virgin Media, I must say, over the years, has morphed into one of the worst companies I've ever had the misfortune of dealing with. Its customer service is terrible. You phone them up. They just don't know what they're talking about. It's the classic overseas call centre problem. They ratchet up your bills maybe once or twice a year for no reason other than to just milk a bit more money out of people. You have to call them up. You get the bill back down and so on. But in return for that, they lock you into another year's contract and so on. Mm-hmm. It's not a great company to be a customer of, but it does provide the TV and broadband and the phone line to my home. And my home doesn't have a BT phone line because when the cable was put in, we're one of the original cable areas. They were quite cunning, the cable companies. They ripped out all the BT lines when they put the cable lines in. So they've got huge captive markets. And I think because our service is so, who knows why, the broadband isn't even that great either. But it's going to be a real pain to move to Sky or to move to one of the sort of BT line-based competitors or to get someone else to put in fibre optic cable or whatever. So we just stick with them and they put the bill up and every so often, about once or twice a year, I get annoyed enough to demand that they put the bill down and then they put the bill down and then they put the bill up again and we go around in circles. And I would say that I wouldn't describe myself as a loyal Virgin Media customer. I think if we were writing a story about someone like me, we'd probably call them a loyal Virgin Media customer.
Yes.
Well, what we just mean is an inertia-prone Virgin Media customer who, despite being annoyed at this company repeatedly, just can't be bothered to move elsewhere and thinks it'd be too much trouble. Nationwide, on the other hand, they're pretty decent. Uh-huh. They've done all right by me over the years. They are a building society. They are a building society that is in all but name a bank. They pay their chief executive far too much money. But they're on our side. They're there for their members. Whether they are or not, I'm not so sure. They're meant to recycle their profits back into offering members better deals. But over the years, they've offered me consistently okay deals and some very good ones. Mm-hmm. At one point, I had a very, very good mortgage from them, which you got loads of freebies that you wouldn't normally get when buying a property. And it was a flex-exclusive mortgage. It was only for their current account customers. I got free legals, free valuation. I think it was even a free home buyer's report. I can't quite remember. But anyway, probably saved us just over a grand, actually, slightly over a grand. And actually, they even did the right thing where the first property that we were going to be buying, it fell through and they gave us another free valuation. Okay. That's not bad, actually, you know. But over the years, these loyalty deals they've offered have drifted lower and lower, and Nationwide has just repeatedly cut savings rates, and it blames all kinds of things, and its thing that it blames at the moment is the fierce competition in the mortgage market, which is very true. There is fierce competition in the mortgage market, but there is a lot of angry Nationwide savers out there, and I think that my loyalty, and it is loyalty to Nationwide, has been severely eroded over the years, and I'm now kind of at the point where I think, what is the point in me being a customer with them anymore, rewarding them with my custom? I have a joint bank account with them, so we have a product that we use all of the time. I have some savings in some of their accounts, earning me a pitiful rate of interest because I'm an idiot and I haven't moved them. But I do think, what's the point in me still being here? Maybe I should just reward another company that I think does better by me, because I also bank with First Direct, and I'm definitely a loyal First Direct customer because they're good. Their customer service is excellent. Again, their savings rates is pretty terrible, but I've got an offset mortgage with them, which helps me out. And whenever you call them up and you've got a problem, they fix it. But
But that's not loyalty.
No,
no. You're getting a good service from a company.
Yeah, you're getting a good service, and so I'm loyal to them because they're providing me with a good service.
That's not loyalty.
No, that is, because I feel a sense of... Because I feel that I'm happy to continue to reward them with my custom. That is what loyalty is, isn't it? You're saying if there was something better...
Would you still... That's the point.
Okay, so I also have a Starling bank account that I opened up over the summer in order to... get fee-free spending overseas. Their app's pretty good. I'm quite happy with the bank account. I quite like the app and everything like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought about maybe I should move my First Direct account there, but I decided not to. So there is an element of loyalty
there. Then if First Direct messed you over, you would jump.
Well, yes.
So then you're not loyal. The point of loyalty is if someone does you wrong, you're still going to stick by them.
Do you know there have been occasions where I haven't been entirely happy with what they've done and I have decided to stick by them. But that is the difference between... But I'm saying the difference between my Virgin Media account is inertia. The difference between that and sticking with Nationwide over the years is loyalty. The difference between I shop in Tesco, which is round the corner from me, and Sainsbury's because they are there. I shop in my local butcher because I am loyal to shopping in my local butchers. Why am I loyal to shopping in my local butchers? Because I like him, because I get on with him, because he knows
me.
He knows the kids. And he always sells me good meat at a decent price. But he's just providing me with the basic service I would expect from a small local shopkeeper. He's nice to me rather than rude, and he sells me good food at a reasonable price. But that's still loyalty.
But if he didn't, this is the point, if he didn't do those things, it doesn't come down to loyalty. Maybe I'm just too sort of business transactional. I have it in my...
You're the Donald Trump of shopping and banking.
Honestly, there is no emotion in this.
Simon spoke about Tesco there. We should talk about its new loyalty scheme.
Yes, sorry, apologies.
So we're going to find out more details about this next week. But we have the bare basics. And basically, it's whether people are going to be willing to pay $7.99 a month to get a loyalty card. Now,
tell us what the problem was in the first place.
Well, basically,
it was really popular, wasn't it? They were the vanguards. Is that fair to say?
Well,
yes, the club card scheme was pretty.
Love that.
You just hit me with it.
It was pretty much at the forefront, and it was done under Terry Leahy. It was a huge success for them, and it was done in conjunction with this company called Dunnhumby. Really sort of led the way in this customer data stuff and everything, and they realised that they could get customers to sign up, give them their data by offering them small discounts, rewarding them, and they'd offer them discounts that were... they started offering them discounts linked to what they were buying. That meant that the customer was registered, and every time you did your shopping, you swiped your club card or your club card number went in, and that meant that they knew what you were buying. So they got loads and loads of data on customer behaviour and what they were buying. It was so successful that, like Victor Kiam, Tesco went and bought Dunnhumby itself and took the company in-house. It was a huge success and credited with helping Tesco go through that big, big stage of growth through the 1990s and early 2000s. So, yes, you're right.
Well, I just think it's gone stale, isn't it, Georgie? Don't know how successful these loyalty cards are anymore. I don't know how much people really care about them, how much they want to get... You know, they chop all the points down. That's what's happened a lot.
And
that's what's happened with Tesco, yeah. So, you know, the amount you spend, you were getting a certain amount of points, and now that's, you know, got lower and lower. And the same with somewhere like Sainsbury's and Nectar, and Sainsbury's bought Nectar and now revamped that and trying to make that a big push on that again now. The thing is with this new Tesco move, this Club Card Plus, is that they're hoping now, this is like a step up from a loyalty card now. This is something that we've not really seen before, in that they are hoping that shoppers are going to pay $7.99 a month. You know, that's quite a big outlay.
Yeah.
You know, that's like a Netflix subscription these days, actually a little bit less now. But $7.99 is quite a large amount. However, I was thinking about this, and my initial reaction was, gosh, it's ridiculous. Like, why would you bother doing that? But what I think it's trying to do now is get people to buy their own loyalty, almost. So, like, you go, well, I've got this card for $7.99, so I better go to Tesco to, you know, get that money back and a discount back. Otherwise, what was the point? So what you're going to get, you can use it on two spends a month. The maximum discount you can get per shop is £20. So that would mean a £200 spend. So if you did that twice a month, two times £200 spends, all in one go, that's how you could max it out. That would be a £40 discount you'd get on your food shop.
Right.
You know, the trade-off is you're paying $7.99, but that's still a nice £32 a month saving if you do that. That's going to be probably, if you're a big family or someone that uses it a lot, to do that kind of big shop, and that's going to take quite a lot of kind of planning to do that. to make sure that you are getting the full rewards for it. So it's definitely something that
you can only do it twice. You can't do four times 100.
No,
or...
you can't do four. It has to be two big shops. That's what they're saying. It's a maximum of two big shops. So that's you know, they have to put these kind of things in place. Otherwise, you know, people will just benefit from it more, won't they? They're relying on people perhaps not always benefiting from the maximum of this. But I think it's just a way that they're trying to almost get people back into Tesco, back doing their big shop there every couple of weeks, hoping that, especially, you know, it's going to appeal to families that can get that. They can get 10% discounts on...
I was going to say, what else can you get?
You can
get
10% discounts on its clothing, pet food, Tesco Mobile, and you get some certain deals on Tesco credit cards and all that type of thing. So it's an all-encompassing card.
I'm not blown away, Lee.
I'm not blown away, Georgie, but if you, as I say, if it doesn't alter your habits, if you're already somebody that goes to Tesco fortnightly, spends £200 roughly, you know, even a little bit less than that, you're going to benefit probably from this card. But I would say, A, remember that you might already be a club card holder anyway. I'm going to suggest that anyone that gets this is going to probably already be a club card holder, the large majority of. So you're already, the trade-off is you're already signed over your data and they can see what your spending habits are, et cetera, et cetera. But be aware of that. Don't let it influence your shopping habits. You know, don't make it change what you were going to do anyway, because Tesco, of course, is not necessarily the cheapest place to get your shop anyway. I've seen the German discounters, you know, they're always saying, this basket of goods is X amount cheaper than X basket of goods at Tesco. So that might eat away at the savings anyway, because a £200 shop at Tesco might be 150 quid at a different supermarket. You know, so you might save that way. I think it just can't shape your habit. You can't go, right, now I've got this card, now I'm just using Tesco, nothing else. I think it is always vital to shop around. I'm someone that is not loyal to a supermarket whatsoever. I've got all of the big supermarkets within a 10-minute drive radius of my house. We do a mixture of everything, but these days, you know, Aldi is the one for us. You know, it is good quality, it's cheap. We do 75% of our shop there. I'd say the rest is a trickle of M&S, bit of Waitrose and a bit of Sainsbury's. There's a much more of being a drive to like these Tesco Express and Sainsbury's Local and all that type of thing. People tend to do their shopping in drips and drabs, and we do our shopping in drips and drabs. Really, one of my biggest nightmares is,
have you ever spent £200 in one pot?
No, well, one of my biggest nightmares is the food shop, Georgie, and it's definitely one of the biggest nightmares for my wife as well. She absolutely hates it. I don't like online food shopping.
No.
I mean, it's not for me. I like the convenience factor of it, but I always find everything's got a sell by date of tomorrow, and I hate that. That is why actually we go to Aldi a lot. We could be in and out, spend £100 in 20 minutes just by whipping around, because the supermarket is the perfect size. More than quality, more than price, more than anything else, it's just the perfect size. Aldi and Lidl, I think, have been really clever in that respect. I haven't got time to drool around a supermarket for two hours.
Some people enjoy that, Lee.
You know, 14 million different brands of ketchup. Just one ketchup, I'm done. It's fine. You know, but you know what I'm trying to say.
Exactly,
you know, you got all the cereals, you know, and it's like all these different, like, Rice Krispies. It's like, I just want one box of Rice Krispies. All the same, they'll come out the same warehouse.
And can I say, from the kids' perspective, is anything more traumatic than losing your mum in a supermarket? We've all done it, haven't we all done it? I'm horrified.
Well,
I'm
still in a stage where daughter can be strapped in, so she's not on it, she's not walking yet.
For her sake. The timing as well, I think, is quite interesting. Just before Christmas, actually, people are probably more likely to have, you know, a couple of big shops or four big shops in the run up to Christmas, and therefore you've got most of your money back. But Simon.
Well, it's quite cunning, isn't it, really, this thing from Tesco, because effectively what this is a subscription, and subscriptions are the old thing that are the new big thing. Mm. If you talk to anybody in the startup world at the moment, consumer-facing businesses, it's all about the subscriptions. It's all about getting people to sign up subscriptions. Why is that the case? Well, because once they sign up, they very rarely cancel them. And it is a really nice, steady stream of income. If you think about some of these young startup businesses that really struggle to make a certain amount of money off a consumer every year, they'll have a certain amount of money they want to get off each customer. And if they could get 30 or 40 quid off each customer, a lot of these would be very, very happy. But if you can sign them up to a subscription, well, you're getting a certain amount of money from them every single month. Tesco is in an awesome position to try and do this, because it is the country's largest supermarket. It has loads of customers. Thanks to its club card system, it has the names, addresses, details of all those customers, and it knows what they buy. And it can say to them, look, you spend money at Tesco, you could probably save money with this. Why don't you sign up? £7.99 a month.
Yeah.
That's not that much money. I mean, you know, if you compare it to the cost of three or four cups of coffee or so on and so on. It's cheaper than your Netflix subscription now and so on. Hey, why not sign up? People do, and they think, yeah, I could save the money back. It's quite cunning, this two big shops thing, isn't it? That you can only do it in two big shops, and you can get a maximum 20 quid off per shop. I mean, 200 quid shop is massive.
Yeah, I know. Who
right?
does? I've never.
Our shop, we shop in what we do one big shop each week as a family. We do online shopping, okay, because ooh. Basically, well, you say that, and I still prefer to walk around a shop and look at what I want for dinner. But realistically, what you actually do as a family is you buy the same stuff every single week. You kind of tend to eat a series of the same meals, or you need the same things. You just simply have the same stuff set up to order every week. Every week, someone comes around, delivers it to your door, and you don't have to do the boring bit of shopping. I like shopping.
Really?
Yes. I like shopping for food and looking for, because I like food and I like cooking. But I don't like shopping for the boring stuff that we just have to order every single
toilet
week.
Roll and that sort of
yeah,
stuff.
I mean, that's dull. That's ruining the fun bit of shopping. So that you do the boring bit of shopping that gets delivered to your door, and then you can get to do the fun bit everywhere else. So the boring bit of our shop for the family costs about 70 to 80 quid a week. And then, you know, on a Friday evening, Saturday or something, when it's time for the weekend, cook something a bit different for dinner, I go out and see by how much I can run up our food bills extra. And you'd be amazed at what I can do. You go into the shop, you get the food and everything for dinner, you pay for it, and you think, how did I just spend 45 quid? It would have been cheaper to just have a takeaway. Sometimes you do it and you think, maybe we should have just gone out for dinner.
Yeah.
But anyway, you know, two big shops, and do you have to do them in store? Can you do them online? Because if you can't do them online, then that's even more cunning. Because if they're dragging people
Lee,
into the
do
shop...
Have an answer?
I actually don't know. The full details are going to be launched next week. I don't think they've revealed whether
and
or
that
not...
Is and also, there's going to be some exclusions to things from
like
the
TVs
shop.
TVs or something, right?
Well, TVs, you would obviously expect that, but is booze going to be included? Yeah, you know, so yeah. For example,
good question.
Very good question.
Could you? Are bottles of wine? Bottles of wine have the ability to seriously bump up the cost of your shop. Or you could just every once a month or once every couple of months just bung something in. You know, bung a couple of bottles of champagne in that you're going to give to people or something like that. And it's like, oh, quickly made my money back, and that'll help pay for my subscription for the year. But the thing is most people just are not cunning enough to max this kind of stuff out. I don't doubt that there'll be lots of people who do actually end up saving some money off the back of it, but they probably won't be saving quite as much as they think. And somewhere there's someone who's done some very sophisticated modelling on this to work out how Tesco's actually going to turn a profit. And it may be that it's not from the discounts on the shopping. It may be that it's from getting more people in and then they spend extra in the shop, or they buy some other things, or they do some other stuff. Or just having that, or being able to say to their investors, well, we've now signed up 500,000 people to pay us $7.99 on Clubcard. And if you tell investors that, they're going to go, ooh, nice, like that, subscriptions, shiny, new.
Or it may not work that way. It may just have completely balls it up. But our survey says to the Tesco Loyalty Club Super Duper Whooper Card.
Depends on who you are.
I'm not getting one.
Simon.
You know my views on this.
I know, right?
Life's too short for loyalty card discount websites and cashback.
I have so many, I forget what I've got in there. All right, well, let's move on from loyalty. Who knew we could speak so long about it? Actually, we all did. But anyway, back in the day, we're going to completely shift gear. The standard route to buying your first house was to rent first and then to save your money and then buy. Oh, how things have changed. But now, it may not only be cheaper to buy, though, but a heck of a lot cheaper. A study's been done by the Mortgage Lenders Trade Association, and they found that effectively, over 30 years, if house prices don't even rise, you could buy two for one. You could save yourself 350,000, which seems an extraordinarily large amount of number. seems an extraordinary high number, but they've also reported a reduction in home ownership rates among younger people than in years gone by. So are young people missing out? Lee, this is a question that I've seen pop up, and we've covered it on this show over the years a fair few times. That kind of argument is cheaper to buy, cheaper to rent. So do we finally have conclusive evidence then?
I think that, Georgie, this topic, it is one of those things where it's kind of, a lot of it is down to your own personal circumstances, isn't it? I find it's quite hard to get a sweeping view of everyone's mm-hmm. life, because a lot of people are in, you know, different boats, different circumstances. So it's more of a kind of like way of showing perhaps that how high rents have got and how much or rent is eating up people's wages, especially here we're talking about probably people under 35, I would suggest, but not just completely resigned to them. But, you know, as someone that bought a house a few years ago and also rented for, you know, best part of my adult life, mm-hmm. you know, I look at these figures and of course it makes total sense. So once you strip away, you know, things like the deposit and all that kind of thing, well, I touched on it earlier in the show, mortgage rates are just at such a low level. And we'll write a story about mortgage rates, for example, and we will have lots of readers that, you know, are quite a bit older, and we'll, you know, talk about, you know, the 80s and 90s when, you know, we were talking double digit mortgage interest, and, you know, we don't know how great we've got it, all us, you know, younger homeowners, which, in a way, yes, I understand, but also it's very unlikely that we're going to witness another 30 years of property price growth in which that generation have seen. I would argue, who knows? You know, I'm not a Mystic Meg. I don't know what's going to happen in the future of house prices. But as someone that has rented and someone that has bought, the difference between renting a one-bedroom, very, very, very small flat in London to owning a three-bedroom house in a nice town in Essex, the difference monthly outlay between the rent and the mortgage, we're paying about £350, maybe £400 a month less on the mortgage for that house than I was for rent in that tiny flat. You know, it's all about location. It's a very southeast focused example. But if you extrapolate that over, you know, a decade, of course I've gonna have saved a large chunk of money from not renting, and you know, I'm chipping away at the house. Hopefully the house is growing a little bit in value. And of course, I'm going to be far better off. But
you've got something to leave the little one?
So to leave the little one. But it's hard, isn't it? It's very, very, very difficult to get onto the property ladder for younger people. Runaway house prices are to blame for that. We have had decades of house price inflation that has just gone absolutely, to pardon the pun, through the roof. I also think sometimes being a homeowner isn't all it's cracked up to be. I think we are in an era in which, you know, especially young people that aren't on the property ladder, you see, for example, all of these influencers on social media, you know, decorating these houses. There's lots of like these interiors, like almost like imagine owning your own home and having all of this glossy stuff around the house. But what you don't hear about is things like, oh, you got to replace the boiler. That's £3,000. And then you get like five people around to give you a quote, and they're all quoting absolutely crazy amounts of money. And then you've got a slight leak somewhere, and then like something's not working in the house. You know, a door, you got to replace the front door. That's another £1,000. You know, it's just all these things add up. And sometimes, you know, it's not as glamorous as what you think. Yes, I'm not glad to be a homeowner, but it was a much simpler life when we owned a flat. You know, we had to be really brutal with what was in the house, in the property, for example. But anyway, look, I'm going off on a tangent here.
I think it's really important that you make that argument, because I mean, I think about it, I think, God, in 10 years, if I keep renting as I am, I could have easily paid for a house just off the bat, like the amount I'm paying for rent. Mm-hmm. But actually, in terms of lifestyle now, we're getting more and more people who are freelancing. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of people moving around the country mm-hmm. or moving to a different country. You don't know where you're going to be. You know, later in life, you're getting married, etc. So it's harder if you're single. There's all sorts of considerations as to why actually buying a property may not be right for you. As much as we look at the financials, why can't we start looking at renting being a good option for people and have the same protections in there and the same encouragements? Not everybody wants to buy.
Well, it is a good option for most people. Okay, yes, there's plenty of horror stories about renting. I'm sure that you can tell us a few if we decide to ask you, Georgie. I've heard them previously. But for every horror story about renting, there's like another 10 of people who just didn't have a problem. And there are lots of landlords out there who look after their tenants.
Lovely, lovely.
There's lots of letting agents out there who make sure that their landlords look after their tenants. Not some of the bigger high street sharky chains that have got in trouble and given everyone else a bad name, or some of the small independent sharks that do it. But there are people out there. And the best thing you can do as a landlord is have a happy tenant, because what happens is, unless you are in a big city, particularly somewhere like London, or maybe a big university town, if your tenants leave, then it's going to take you time to find new ones. So you only have to go out into the commuter belt, and it can take people maybe 3 or 4 months to find tenants. And if your property is sitting empty for 3 or 4 months and you're still paying a mortgage, it could wipe out every single penny of profit that you would make over the course of that year. But broadly speaking, for most people, they don't move around that often. They do tend to live in the same place for a long time. They do tend to do the same job and things like that. And actually, at the moment, they would be better off buying a home. As Lee said, mortgage rates are so cheap. Now, this is quite a detailed piece of research from the Intermediary Mortgage Lenders Association. I'm not sure whether they would have issued the research if it had come out saying that you'd be much better off renting, because the clue is in the name, the Intermediary Mortgage Lenders Association.
You think that?
Yeah, there is definitely a vested interest here. But actually, when you look at the figures, they've been done properly. You drill down into them, they work. And you would be £352,500 better off over 30 years. And they did factor in maintenance. They did factor in buying costs. And they also didn't put this is how much your house is going to appreciate by. They factored in zero house price appreciation over that time. So they've done a reasonably fair job on it. And one of the key points that they were making in this report, and one of the reasons why they did this report, was to highlight the fact that there's a generation that's going to miss out because of this, or there's going to be a generation of haves and have-nots because of it, because it's so much harder for people to buy a home now, and there's less people getting onto the property ladder. Because what this depends on is you're buying the average home of £230,000 with a 95% loan-to-value mortgage. So you're getting on with a small deposit.
Yeah.
But actually, once you do the maths on that, that's a £218,000 mortgage, which you're going to steadily pay off over the 25 years. And I'll come to that in a minute. But in order to get that £218,000 mortgage, you're going to need to have saved a deposit of £11,500. Now, for people who are benefiting from a big sum of money from the bank of mum and dad, that probably doesn't sound like so much. But for if you're saving that money yourself, it's really hard to save £11,500. That's years of saving. And if you feel that house prices keep moving away from you while you're doing it, that's an issue.
Yeah.
Now, fortunately for people at the moment, those house prices aren't moving away from them while they're doing it. But they have been in recent years. But also, in order to get that £218,000 mortgage, if you work on the basis of it being a roughly four times your salary, you're going to need to be earning £54,500. Now, for most individuals, that is completely beyond them. The median wage in this country is about £27,000. Mm-hmm. If you were buying as a couple, then that's doable. But not everybody can buy as a couple. But, you know, if you can buy as a couple, then that's doable. But that's still above the household earnings of most people. Also, as I said, this is worked on the basis of the interest charge on a 25-year mortgage. Now, you may note that many people are not taking out 25-year mortgages at the moment, particularly first-time buyers. In fact, they're taking 30-year mortgages, 35-year mortgages. There's even been talk that the norm will become a 40-year mortgage. And if you suddenly start paying interest over 40 years, then whilst your monthly payments will be lower to begin with, so it will seem cheaper, you'll pay an awful lot more interest to the bank or building society over those 40 years. And that does change the figures. But it is a good piece of research. Two good pieces of research in 2 weeks, done really well. Amazing, hey? And it does highlight how there is this issue. And
that's the point of it, isn't it? It's not to say, you can buy two houses.
Yeah.
It's saying, look, actually, we've changed society. We've changed.
Yeah, because what it's saying is, for all of the things that we've tried to do to try and help first-time buyers onto the property ladder, the main problem is that houses are really expensive, and that means that lots of people are struggling to buy, and we're going to end up with a generation of haves and have-nots. Yeah,
precisely.
Exactly.
It's so difficult for a young person, especially someone that isn't in a couple, to save up the required deposit, to have, you know, lendability, i.e., earn enough salary to be taken seriously by a bank to get lending. But I do think that they have got it harder than any other generation to buy a property. And people like to own their own property. They've seen these decades of house price growth and think, well, I want a bit of that. You want security as well, you know. I think there has been big strides in recent years in terms of renting, in terms of things getting a little bit better. And you can look at, you know, some examples in other countries in which it is a lot of renting done. For example, Germany, you know, a lot of those cities, there's a lot of renting goes on there. And home ownership isn't quite as important. We are obsessed in this country with home ownership and property prices. It is a pretty reasonable assumption.
When I would have been listening to you thinking, God, I wish I owned my own home. And do you know what? Now I think it's not right. It's not right for me. I don't have a... Maybe in the future, you know, when I'm really old as opposed to old. But it works for me. I like the flexibility. I like the fact that I'm pretty lazy when it comes to, you know, if something goes wrong, I can just text my landlord and he'll sort it out. It works for me right now. It may not work forever, but it works for me. All right, we're going to move on. We're going to talk about shares. Let's smash through this one, Simon. When you decide to buy shares in a company, of course, there's a number of things that you will be considering. The usual, the profits, the margins, the debt, the growth, etc., etc. But do you check what the bosses of the business are up to? Are they themselves buying into their own company? And if not, why not? Now, Warren Buffett likes this skin in the game approach. So, Simon, who are we to argue with the Oracle, really?
Yes. So, lots of executives, chief executives, people in the sort of top tier of a company will hold shares in that company. Many of them will be paid a substantial amount of their substantial wages in shares in that company. That's not what you're looking for, them being rewarded with large share-based payments or bonuses. What you're looking for is those company bosses who are so confident in the fact that their company is going to not only be doing well at the moment, thus delivering them that craved for bonus, but going to continue doing well into the future. And that's going to mean that its share price is going to go up and it's going to reward investors, that they are happy to put their hands into their own pockets and buy more shares in the company that they work for. This is what's known as director dealings. You can look these figures up. You can look these figures up on This Is Money, thisismoney.co.uk/market data. You'll find the director dealings, shows the latest director deals, because director deals have to be revealed and announced officially. What you're looking for is big purchases. And that says that they're feeling pretty confident. There's a few red herrings that you can find sometimes. There might be some share reward schemes that mature. Generally, that would be relatively small numbers of shares. Also, what you're looking out for is directors dumping big chunks of stock in the company they work for, because that's obviously the indication that they're not so confident in it. But again, there can be personal reasons here. For example, the classic one is paying for a divorce.
How can you check that out? Or why would you?
Google their name and divorce. Quite often there might be some form of news report that mentions it. It is slightly difficult to check. Sometimes companies, when someone is selling a big chunk of shares, they might even give a reason for that sale. Right. They might want to get that out there, because company X, if the chief executive suddenly dumps a huge amount of stock in company X, people are going to notice, and company X is going to want people to know that it's because he's buying a new house, because he's getting divorced, because his children are going to university and he's got to pay £4 million for their university tuition fees. I'm joking. But yeah, so watch out for these things. But as with anything else, it is not to be taken in isolation. If you are buying individual shares, you need to do your own research. You need to look into company reports. You need to look at the fundamentals. You need to look at indicators like this. But never just use one indicator in isolation. You need to be looking at all of the other things. So don't just sit there looking at the director dealings and go, ooh, that boss has just bought a load. I'm going to buy a load too.
That is good advice, as always.
Oh, and also watch out for them buying large amounts of stock after profit warnings. Okay, now that is an indication of confidence, and they think that the profit warning is overcooked and a big share price fall has been overcooked. But be careful that they don't then just sell that stock about 3 weeks later and it's just an artificial confidence boosting measure.
Tricks of the trade there. Thank you very much, Simon. Right, moving on. If you are in the market for a car, you're basically going to drive into the ground, then your motoring correspondent, Rob Hull, has found the perfect car for you, apparently, Lee. It is, wait for it, a Skoda. Apparently, there are more Skoda Octavias out there with 250,000 miles on the clock than any other model. So, Lee, what else makes the top 10 workhorse cars? I'm just thinking about how you would spend £200 in a supermarket, and who would put 250,000 miles on a clock?
The taxi drivers. Taxi drivers are a classic one, and, you know, people that, you know, have big families or might have family, you know, across the country that they might be driving a lot over weekends and things. Reps.
Company reps, the guys who trawl up and down the motorway every day. Right. That's what you got. You get cars that are called rep-mobiles. Company cars, these guys are doing miles and miles and miles. You know, they might be doing 300 miles a day.
Exactly, and it adds up. And it's actually, this list is brilliant. I really, really, really like this. So it's basically a top 10 cars that are still on the road, have valid MOTs, and are still going with over 250,000 miles on the clock. And the reason why I like this is that I think we are, especially growing more and more into a throwaway society in which we are used to upgrading our mobile phones every couple of years, in which we get cars on, you know, higher leases after 3 years, give them back, get a new one, give it back, get a new one. It proves that there are things that are out there that are built to last, and Skoda's always been known as a bit of a workhorse car. You know, engines go for quite a long time. When you see, if you ever sort of just stand around and look at taxis and what taxi drivers are driving, a large chunk of them are Skodas, you know, because they can be basically ran into the ground. So there's almost 2,000 Octavias with over 250,000 miles on the clock. They've been around since 1998. I don't think those people are going to be necessarily looking to sell their Octavias, though. Georgie said the used car market might be a bit difficult to, you know, people keep hold of them because they know how long they can last. But of course, if you want something that's going to be relatively cheap and has got, you know, I think sometimes used car buyers look and they see something with over 100,000 miles on the clock and you think, no, you know, which is, you know, is more dangerous because there are more chances of things going wrong and there being failure and there being expensive repairs. But, you know, this shows that, you know, sometimes some of these cars can last. Now, there's a top 10 list here. We've got a VW Passat, Toyota Prius.
What's your favourite? We don't have to go through all of them because Mondeo, really Rob's Golf. SEO numbers.
I quite like a Golf. And I think there's a new Golf being launched this week, actually. I really like old school Golfs. You know,
they're always reliable, aren't they? Everybody's favourite, the VW.
People love a Golf.
Apart from
Golfs are phenomenally easy cars to sell secondhand. Yeah. I mean, and that's a car that's not been used as a taxi.
Yeah,
definitely.
That's just a popular workhorse car.
So the other thing I thought was quite interesting about this is that they also did it with vans. They had a whole section for vans and taxis, so actual like black cabs, basically.
Yeah.
But the Mercedes Sprinter, there's almost 10,000 of them on the road that have got more than 250,000 miles on the clock, which is a high amount. But these things get used as like shuttles to airport runs and all that type of thing. But it's almost double a Ford Transit, which is number two. So those Mercedes Sprinters, you know, are really being built to last, and people are keeping on with them and just clocking up the mileage on them. That's good. That's great, I think, for a company, a manufacturer like Mercedes to see that, you know, a vehicle like that, it's just proof in the pudding, isn't it? That these are still running.
So you can divide people, you can divide car buyers into two groups, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's people who are terrified of high mileage cars and like to buy the lowest possible mileage car that they can and get worried when the mileage starts racking up. And then there's people who look at the other people's way of thinking as a way of getting bargain cars and cheaper cars. And it depends what camp you fall into, really. It's just a personal preference kind of thing. Personally, I love a high miler. So when we bought our last family car, it was 5 years old, 4 or 5 years old when we bought it. We bought it with 60,000 miles on the clock. Now, there would have been lots of people out there who would have thought, I want to try and buy the one with the lowest possible mileage. I want to get one with 30,000 miles. I want to get one that's only done, you know, someone's done it, used only 5,000 miles a year, 6,000 miles a year. Or you can look at it and go, well, do you know what? Modern cars, they can run for a long time. It's got a fairly big engine in it. If you look for someone who's done 10,000 miles a year, motorway miles are very easy on a car. They're much better you're much better off having a car that's done racked up lots of motorway miles than you are having a car that's done small amounts of town miles and stop start driving. And if you go for the car that's got 60 odd thousand miles on it, versus the car that's got 30,000 on it. We bought a car for 14 grand. Probably the 30,000 mile car would have been maybe 15, 16 grand. So you're saving ourselves a bit of money. But do you know the highest mileage on a car that you've ever owned and run?
What, me personally?
Yeah. Any idea?
I buy low and then they
again, go high.
I sell high, but I don't sell them. I just run them into the ground. 100 and something, 140,000 maybe?
That's a big number.
Is that?
Lee, any ideas?
I might have just made that up, but I think that's about right. 140 something. It was an Audi, actually, I think.
I don't think I've ever really driven anything that's had a high mileage at all, but my wife, Danielle, had a Saxo, and she had it for brand new, and she had it for about 12 years until it was stolen and written off. But she'd done something like 28,000 miles on it. In like 14 years, it was in great condition.
Okay, so,
yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Right, so
opposite end of the scale.
I asked Rob this, our deputy motoring editor, yesterday, and he reckoned the highest he's had was about 85,000 miles.
Yeah.
I was like, but he's had a number of high mile cars, but he didn't reckon he'd had one higher than that. So we've had. Our old Alpha, we had an Alpha 147 and we sold that. I looked that up on the MOT check yesterday to find out. I think we sold that just below 100,000 miles. We then had a Jaguar X-Type Estate. We sold that on 125,000, 126,000 miles. Our current car, I reckon, which is another Jaguar and XF, that's got about 90,000 miles on the clock. And my 205 GTIs on 145,000 miles, and that's a 1991 car. But you know, and there, that's a great example. The classic car thing, the ones that are worth the most money are the low milers. My GTI will never be worth tons of money because it's got high miles on it. But I bought it to drive it. And actually, what you want is a car that's been driven enough that it's been looked after if you buy it to drive it, because quite often you can then get less problems than if you went for one that had hardly been driven at all over the last 5 to 10 years. But I'll tell you a story about a low miler as well that I had. When I was 20, I think, I got a Volkswagen Polo, old-fashioned, 1 litre, bread van-shaped Volkswagen Polo. My dad bought it from a friend of his at work, whose mum had owned it, and she was literally the one careful lady owner who'd only ever driven it once a week to the supermarket and back. It was a 1984 A-Reg Volkswagen Polo. I got it in 1999, and it had 5,000 miles on the clock.
No.
It was a proper time warp car.
Wow,
you got into it, it was immaculate. It was like getting into a car from 1984.
All right.
Absolutely amazing.
Can you beat that in low, or can you beat it high? Get in contact with us. Love to know. This is a whole new game of how much mileage have you got in your car. But yeah, can you beat Simon's 5,000?
Lowest, well, that's over a long period. You could obviously easily get a 5,000 mile car if you bought one that was a couple of years old.
Or my
What's the oldest car with the lowest mileage you've bought on it? And what's the highest mileage car you've ever run to?
Right, mine's 3 years with 12,000.
Right.
That's not really that impressive, is it? But anyway, let us know yours.
Yes, you can tweet us at This Is Money. Probably don't email us all these car ones.
No,
you can do if you like.
Tweeting
editor at thisismoney.co.uk. They might get lost in all the emails we get sent to the editor inbox. You could put high mileage cars for the podcast in the subject line, or come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast. Where you can comment on the articles as well.
Indeed. You can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you do like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.